Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Hey everyone, it's Tim here again. We received a lot of feedback about the series and I have loved reading all your messages, even the ones who were furious at Carlo and me. A lot of people wanted to hear more from our final guest, Abby Howells, so I've decided to add our chat with her pretty much unedited in all its glory. Enjoy! And if you're in Auckland, see you at the live show on November 18th. It is now my great pleasure and honour to welcome to this final episode of the first season, probably the only season, of Did Titanic Sink, Dr. Abby Howells, PhD. I must hasten to add, it's not in a related field to this particular topic, but she's done the work, so I think she deserves to be credited.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Dr. Abby.
Oh, hi. That's actually the first time I've ever been introduced with my title.
Really?
Yeah.
It is pretty fresh, right?
It's pretty fresh, yeah. But you know what? It makes the 4 years of agony worth it.
We probably should state what your PhD was in.
It's in theatre studies.
And specifically,
women in prison, the way they were presented in film and television and theatre.
So, the perfect person to come on a podcast about the Titanic.
I'm an expert.
So, Carlo.
Tim. Dr. House.
I gave you a little bit of a heads up about Abby because I was very excited to get her on this episode.
I have to admit, when Tim first introduced me to the idea of getting on the podcast, he started off by saying, I know a comic who has their PhD in the Titanic. And then very quickly he's like, oh no, she's got a PhD on steamships. And then it was like, no, I think she just likes the Titanic and has a PhD. So, you know, I was really set up.
Yeah.
But as I understand it, Abby, you're just like me. You're like an amateur historian who's obsessed about the Titanic, right?
Yes, absolutely. My qualifications are I'm on the autism spectrum and the Titanic is one of my special interests. So you could say in some ways a PhD only lasts 4 years, but a special interest lasts a lifetime.
But, That's very true.
I feel like me and Tim definitely had a conversation and he walked away and I thought, oh no, he thinks I have a PhD in the Titanic.
I grabbed the bits that I wanted. I went, she's got a PhD, yeah. She's hyper educated on the Titanic, and yeah. I mushed them together in my head. But it feels like you have the depth of knowledge equivalent to someone who's studied it to a doctoral level from my amateur estimation anyway. So, Abby, can you first just give us a little bit of broad background about your prior knowledge about Titanic coming into listening to this podcast?
Okay. Well, I first became obsessed with the Titanic when I was about 10, and I can trace it back to an event, which is me and my dad and my sister were really into boogie boarding. We went out one day onto Katatane Beach and we got caught in a rip. We're almost drowned. And I almost drowned to the extent that, like, I was under the water so long that I started to go towards the light. Like, I had this really clear memory of, like, floating upwards toward this light before my dad grabbed the back of my wetsuit and threw me forward. And we all survived, and it was fine. But since then, I don't go in the sea, and I get scared going in swimming pools as well. But I became obsessed with the sea and sort of, like, maritime disasters because, you know, she's such a cruel mistress. She almost claimed me.
Yes.
I wanted to know everything about her. So I became obsessed. Like, I love pirate stuff, Kraken stuff, whale stuff, and ghost ships like the Mary Celeste. But of course, the mother of all nautical disasters is the Titanic. So that was the one that took a lot of my focus. And I became obsessed with the Titanic, learned everything about it. But my particular interest was the passengers and kind of where they were at each in the crew and where they were at what point in the night and kind of what they did in those moments. And I think because I was analyzing myself earlier and I was like, maybe I'm obsessed with, you know, when confronted with death, what did they do? Because I just seemed to succumb to it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was just like, c'est la vie, I'm 10 years old. I've had great innings.
So you already knew about the legendary Archibald Butt.
Yeah, I already knew about a noble heroic death. And then, you know, you have the people like the J. Bruce Ismays, who, well, it's sort of villainized to an extent for taking a place on the life raft. And you have the people like the Strausses, who Ida and Isidore Strauss, who she refused to get into a life raft without him. So she stayed on the boat and she went down with him on the ship.
See, there's so many stories. There's so many heartbreaking and interesting tales associated with this one event.
Yeah, someone released all the dogs.
What do you mean? How many dogs were on board?
There was quite a few dogs, eh, Carla? There was like 16 dogs?
Yeah, there were, yeah. I think only one survived, is that right?
Yeah, a Pomeranian that was on the lap of a first-class passenger. But someone in their final moments chose to release the dogs. So when you think of the Titanic, there are dogs running along
deck. God.
Oh, actually, and one survivor was found, she was bobbing in the water holding onto a dog.
Oh,
I know.
Heartbreaking scenes.
Yeah, yeah. But that's what someone did. Someone was like, I got to give these dogs a chance.
So with all of this passion and prior knowledge and reading and voracious absorption of any morsel of information associated with this event, and you can tell us straight, what did you think of the series?
Oh, Carlo, you had me completely convinced. Nah, psych! I got some questions.
Okay, well, let's flip the tables. Normally, we ask our guests some questions, but if you've got anything that you want to throw at Carlo, ask Carlo, go right ahead.
All right, Carlo, the jewel in the crown for a lot of people that really believe in that it was the Olympic that was sunk instead of the Titanic is the portholes, which I'm not sure I've heard you mention. What's your opinion on the portholes and the difference between the Titanic and the Olympic?
One of the two of you have to explain what this is, because I have no idea.
Just to rehash, Abby, Dr. House.
You can call me Abby.
Yeah, I quite like calling you Dr. House because it feels like we're getting to the bottom of a mystery, you know, in Victorian England.
Well, don't call me Dr. House away.
So, Dr. House, this is about the fact that the Titanic should have had one more porthole than the Olympic. Is that right? Have I gotten this fact?
Yeah, so the Olympic, I believe, had 14 irregular holes and Titanic had 16 regular holes. And a lot of
16, yes.
Olympic believers seem to really hang their hat on these portholes. And apparently there's like images and stuff of the Titanic pulling away, but it only had 14 portholes. But I wanted to know your opinion on that particular factoroony.
This smells like a fucking setup to me.
One of the reasons I didn't want to talk about it, that of all of the other evidence to me feels very much about like the quality of evidence that we have. And a lot of it is like, oh, this photo shows that there's 14 portholes. But the arguments against it is normally, well, it's very hard to tell in this angle of photograph, or the quality of the photograph isn't enough to actually show us. So while I agree that it could definitely be possible that, and it should in fact be possible that there's 14 portholes on it because it's the Olympic, I am just not convinced by the quality of evidence being brought up in favour of that. Because it's always just like, check out this photo that was taken on the docks of Belfast down this incredibly steep angle where you can't really even make out all the portholes. Like, and there should be light here, you know? So it just didn't. It didn't feel like this as strong as evidence as, for example, the photo from March 1912, which shows them side by side, and the Titanic hasn't had its deck completed at that time. That is more compelling to me because it gives us a better time frame. Whereas this, I'm not wholly a fan of the evidence. It feels too easily refuted just by that fact.
Pun. Intended, because the portholes, nice. Carlo.
Very nice.
Oh, you know.
Hey, you know, we love the Titanic, but we're comedians as well.
It's important to remember because some people have forgotten that through the series.
Yeah, it's a maritime disaster, but it's fun to goof around.
Yeah, many perished, but we have a laugh as well.
many lives were lost and laughs were had.
I'll respect that answer as well, because I feel like the most compelling evidence is, I've got to agree with Courtney and Angela, that it's incredibly easy to believe that a corporate fat cat would waste human life in favour of gaining more money. That's the most believable part of this whole thing. Absolutely, that happens every day.
That's what hooked me in as well, to be honest. I was like, that I believe. That's, I don't know about all this other stuff.
Especially because in the, like, very much in the zeitgeist when the Titanic disaster happened, only, I think it's a year before, maybe 2 years before, the Republic sank, which was a ship that had a huge number of passengers. I think it may have even had more passengers than the Titanic. And everybody got off safe because it just sank so slowly. And so the conventional thinking with modern steamships was, you know, even in the worst case scenario, almost everybody should get off. And I think that if you're a fabulously wealthy multi-millionaire, multi-billionaire in our times, and you're just looking at this like, well, I'll sink this ship, I'll make the money back, no one will get hurt, it'll be fine.
Because there's already a blueprint for how it would unfold if the Republic had, like, it had happened, what did you say, a year prior?
I think it's a year prior.
It was an observable method of watching this thing play out in real time. You're like, oh, okay, we could do this. People survive, just waste the ship, get the insurance.
Yeah, and in fact, when the Republic sank, that was one of the big arguments for why these massive ships didn't need more lifeboats, because they were thinking of them as more like a taxiing craft that could take them from one stricken vessel to a safety vessel. And if those other ships also have lifeboats, then that's going to supplement the number of lifeboats that you have. So, yeah, I can definitely see it being something that where a person would go, well, look, no one's going to get hurt. I'm going to make millions of dollars. Maybe a couple of people will perish, and that'd be just like ants to you, you know?
Do you want to hear my reasons that I think that it's untrue, that I'm unconvinced?
Would love to.
Please.
Okay. So my main thinking is that the Olympic, it was not a new vessel. It had been in commission for a year. It had undertaken four trips back and forth from the UK to America. And my feeling is that there's going to be so much wear and tear, it would be impossible to pass it off as an entirely new vessel. I think, you know, Titanic was known as this incredible luxury. It was brand new. That was a thing about it. A huge amount of money would have had to been invested into it to make it look that way. And I think, because you talked about the changes and like these non-structural changes they did to the Titanic, but they added like a lot of like changes they didn't need to. Like, they made the Titanic more luxury. Like, they added in this weird little cafe that was supposed to look like a cafe in Paris, and they just added that
Disneyland.
Yeah, the Cafe Parisian.
Yeah. And they added that into the Titanic, and it had its own unique china. And, like, they didn't have to do that. Why would they do that if they were just going to sink it?
Well, not every, but this is the thing about conspiracy theories as well, or things that happen in history sometimes that are very suspicious. Not everything is related to the conspiracy theory part of what happened, right? Sure. Sometimes it occurred to someone that they wanted to change the china for some other totally different, unrelated reason.
True, but there's so much money, and they commissioned like unique portraits to be hung in the first class smoking lounges and that kind of thing. They sunk a lot of money into the Titanic. I don't know why they would add these like details that it's really costly, and they're not even going to recoup the full amount. Like, it took 7.5 million to build, but the insurance was only for 5 million. So why would they sink in all this cash on commissioning artists to create stuff, creating little Paris cafes, switching the location of the Turkish baths, if they were just going to sink the thing, Carlo?
It's a good question, and interestingly, all of those big works, like the paintings, the crockery, all of that is additionally insured. So they will make their money back on all of those items, because all of them are listed as individual things. I think even Allianz Insurance, that's still around, there were a huge number of different insurance brokers that covered various elements of the Titanic, and they covered a lot of these additional elements. So the factor there of like the cost in those things can be recouped, admittedly. The other thing is, I don't think this was an intended plan years in the making. I feel like it was sort of months in the making, you know, which is the Olympic throws this propeller blade and they're in a huge millions and millions of dollars of debt at this point already. And it's a very quick thing that can be done. Like, the photograph from March shows them being almost still identical. So other than one being unfinished, as it were. So that's the time frame we're thinking, like in a few months. All these things like the crockery, the paintings, they've been commissioned you know, years, sometimes many years in advance, particularly some of those fine furnishings, you know, those things have been in the works far longer than the conspiracy. So it would almost be too obvious to stop those processes, because there's a huge industry. I mean, it's I don't know the exact percentage, but a huge amount of Belfast at this time is involved in the outfitting of ships, like the making of beds and rope, and it's a huge part of their industry. So if you're like, oh, actually, we're not going to do all this luxury on the Titanic, I think that's going to ring more alarm bells than just insuring it and, you know, and recouping that cost. Because I definitely understand what your point is, like, they're going to make less money than it cost them to build it. But when you're cash poor and you have a backlog of ships being made, like, the Britannic is going to come out in a year, which is also identical to these two ships. And after that, they've got plans for the future of bigger ships and better ships. So it's not like they have a shortage of ships that can generate them an income. What they do have at this precise time is, like, a massive, massive deficit of cash. And this is a very relatively quick way to get an influx of liquid money.
Satisfied?
No, that's all right.
On their specific point,
that's, you know, that's a very reasonable argument. I feel like at the moment, Carla, we're like stripped to the waist, both with knives, like circling each other.
I was like,
it's like a duel.
I didn't know if it was sort of my role in the universe to bring the two of you together or to make sure that you never interacted.
This opens up a whole new timeline.
Well, my final point that I was thinking of was, like, in your mind, had they done any restoration on the Olympic before sending it out as the Titanic? Like, are they sending out a damaged vessel?
Yes. The short answer is yes. I would think, as part of this conspiracy, yes. The idea is that all of those, like, quite significant damages to the Olympic, like the damaged propeller shaft, and there's an argument that we didn't talk about in the podcast, but there's this theory that the Olympic apparently had a slight list of port, and people reported the Titanic having a slight list of port, like it's leaning over to the left. Again, I think it's too circumstantial, that evidence, to have brought up, but the main line that I'm saying is the structural impact of that collision with the Hawk had been repaired already, but to an extent that it wasn't a fully fixed ship. My theory is that they then re-outfitted that ship. So it was completely redone. So that question of it wouldn't have looked like a new ship, I think that it very much would have, because they're doing all of this additional carpentry. They're changing A and B decks around. They're moving the Turkish baths. They're creating the Cafe Parisian. These things would have required, like, quite a significant amount of work in the ship itself, and repainting, polishing decks. It's being completely reupholstered. So I think it's been completely re-outfitted. It hasn't been wholly repaired. Like, the damage to the Olympic would still be very much present in the so-called Titanic. It also explains to me why the Olympic, which went in for that propeller repair in March, doesn't come back out to sea until the day that Titanic is leaving on its maiden voyage from Southampton. Like, it's an extraordinary amount of time, and it just sort of silently leaves dock in Belfast on the same day that Titanic's sailing out into the Atlantic. It takes a very long time to fix that one thing.
Okay. Well, if it's seaworthy enough to be sent out with passengers on it, surely it would be easier to just recoup the cost via sending it out and getting passengers to pay for tickets. Because, you know, the top first class ticket, it roughly translates to about $100,000 per cabin, right, in today's money.
Totally. Yes. Yes.
Wouldn't it be easier to just send out the vessel and recoup the costs? Because if it's seaworthy enough to go out there,
look,
why didn't they just do that?
I contend it's a very good point. I think it goes down to the time it will take to recoup this. Like, that $7.5 million that it's taken to build the so-called Titanic, that cost is, we did the maths on it, I think it's $256 million. So even with those, like, massive first-class tickets, there's only so many crossings they can do in a year and only so many crossings they can do in a decade. Like, to actually start to get close to making that money back is going to take an extraordinarily long time. And there's no guarantee that it will. Obviously, they're hugely optimistic in the shipping industry at this time. They're like, this is going to be a golden ticket forever. And then 2 years later, World War One will happen and, you know, scupper so many passenger liners. But at this time, like, the seas are calm as far as they can see, but it's still going to take them, you know, decades to recoup that money just on ticket sales. Whereas this is a really quick way that they can make that money back. Because, as I said, they've the Olympic, which was the Titanic, now disguised as the Olympic, it can get back into work. A year later, the Britannic can get back into work. Suddenly, we've got these two ships making that income, and we've just got back nearly all of the cost of building one of them, which remedies some of these huge legal costs that we have, some of these huge repair costs, and some of the huge lost income, which is, I think, in itself more significant than any of the other costs, purely because the INMC has borrowed so much against these ships. You know, like, they're up for much more by the consequence of those ships not generating income.
Abby, I want to ask you a question.
Please.
I feel, and first an observation and then a question.
Yes.
My observation is that it's been quite interesting to watch Carlo, who went from moments ago admitting that he only really believes this has got a 5% chance of being the reality of what happened in history, to when backed against a corner with, you know, questions and evidence to the contrary and doubt about the theory, he will go right back to his steadfast position of being able to prove very willingly and very, like, forcefully that, no, this is what happened and this is why. The question is, how did you feel as a listener who has joined me on the journey in a different way, because obviously you were so knowledgeable to begin with, of Carlo weaving this tale and putting the pieces of evidence together to create this compelling case and then throw it all away at the end to reveal that he doesn't even fully believe it?
My goodness. I must say, I have loved the podcast so much. May I tell you about my listening experience?
I would love to hear it.
Okay, I listened to episode one, and I was on a train from Edinburgh to London, and I booked a first class ticket because I'm classy, and I had, in first class, they give you food for free. So, well, it's not for free. I would have paid for it.
You don't pay more.
Yeah, I don't pay more for it. So I had a little egg sandwich. I had a cup of tea and I had some crisps as well, and I was going through the English countryside and I was listening to the Titanic podcast, and I honestly had the thought, life could not be better.
That's so sweet.
I was like, I'm heading to London, I get to go to the Victoria and Albert when I get there. Honestly, life could not be better than this. This is, I said to myself, now this is living.
So, and then someone looked over at you and said, I'll have what she's having. And that was five episodes of a conspiratorial podcast.
No, I loved it. It's wonderful. It's like I couldn't love a podcast more, to be honest with you. It felt like listening to two friends, but one of them knew heaps about the Titanic. And you don't often meet people that know heaps about the Titanic. So I loved listening to it. There was stuff that I didn't know that you brought up. So it was a learning experience for me.
What was new, just out of interest?
So my knowledge is, you have a huge practical knowledge of the boat, which I don't have, you know, in terms of like, I knew about the ice tray at the bottom and all this, you know.
The watertight bulkheads.
The watertight bulkheads, you know, on, you know, every basic bridge. I did not. I didn't know as much about the boat. I didn't know as huge amount about the court case and the sort of testimony, as well as I didn't know the hugest amount about the correspondence that happened in the 2 hour radio play. If you know, release the 2 hour radio play cut and I'll listen to it happily. So there's stuff that I didn't know. Yeah, to hear you throw it away at the end, I was like, to be honest, a little annoyed because I had prepared all these really good arguments and I was ready to be like, hey, fuck you, Carlo, come at me. And I was like, I sort of, to be honest, quite arrogantly considered myself to be the final boss of the podcast that you had to convince. And to hear you throw it away, I was like, my presence means nothing. So, but that was arrogant on my behalf.
I couldn't actually remember because I think I asked you when we had a brief conversation about this quite a long time ago when we were, Carlo and I were first sort of cooking up the idea.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't remember your answer to whether or not you believed the conspiracy theory or not, because you were aware of it.
I was aware of it, but I didn't believe it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Too smart. Too cynical.
Yeah, I have, you know, I almost died. I've lived through some things.
You sharpen up your tools when the sea tries to take you.
Exactly.
You pay attention.
When the cruel mistress of the sea tries to take you down, you become wiser and you become stronger.
Because you emerge stronger than before.
Yeah, even if, you know, in the moment, you kind of just sort of just let her take you, really.
That's the transformation. But did you feel a little bit betrayed then when Carlo threw it all away?
I must say I was a little bit betrayed, Carlo, but... you know, at the same time, I have an immense respect for you, but and I guess that's why the betrayal hurt.
As a fellow intense fanatic of this topic as well, though, can you understand the motivation that Carlo had, which was to essentially figure out a way to trap me in a room, to tell me about Titanic and to engage me in his Titanic chatter for multiple days?
Absolutely, I relate to that because I feel like that's what I do all the time with my comedy shows because my other interest is the Tudors. And I spend a lot of time in my comedy show telling the audience about the Tudors. And I often have the thought of like, wow, people have paid to see me do this. This is the dream. And I'm just standing here talking about the Tudors. Which is information that nobody would have listened to. I did this show last week. A lady tried to correct me on the Tudors. Can you believe that?
How did that go? Give us the blow-by-blow. What did she try to correct you on?
She tried to correct me on Mary the First. Something about Mary the First. I can't know exactly what she said. But I was like, ma'am, you have put a knife to a gunfight here. Couldn't believe
it. Did you slap her down proper?
That happened on stage. I was like, I can't believe you would have the audacity to come in here.
Wait, was that a heckler?
Yeah,
I thought you mean after the show.
No, she heckled me with a fact during the show.
Man, was it a fact or was it a fiction?
It was an absolute fiction. It was an old wives' tale.
Dogs.
And I even said at the beginning of the show, I said, hello, everyone. I know some comedians talk to the audience, but I am on the spectrum, so I don't. Because talking to people is not a top strength of mine.
She screwed up twice.
She screwed up twice.
Carlo, I'd like to open up the floor to you if you would like to ask Abby, Dr. Howells, any questions or make any comment based on what you've heard so far.
Yeah, Dr. Howells, I have two questions for you. My first is, who's your favourite passenger or crew member on the Titanic and why?
I was going to ask you this, Carlo. Can you answer it after me?
Yeah, please.
Okay. I feel like you got to respect... I'm pronouncing his name incorrectly, I'm sure, but Charles Joggin, who was the chief baker on board the Titanic.
Let the record state you've stumped Carlo. People can't hear this, but this is the first time I've experienced a piece of Titanic information Carlo was not immediately familiar with.
I probably incorrectly pronounced his name, but he was the one who, he was supposed to man one of the life rafts, but he saw that there was already a crew member on board and he thought, I don't want to take an extra seat, so someone else can take that and I'll stay on the boat. And he loaded up the life rafts with bread, and then he was throwing deck chairs off, and then he had a very relatable instinct, which was, I'm gonna get fucked up.
Oh,
so
this
he
guy.
Went back into the kitchen. Yeah, he went back into the kitchen, just knocked back a bunch of alcohol, and then just was drinking and, like, you know, and throwing deck chairs out. And then he's the last person on board the Titanic because he managed to climb up to the top and get himself on the opposite side of the rails. And then he said he rode it down like an elevator and stepped off the Titanic into the water. But the alcohol kind of helped him survive. So,
like those St. Bernards that they send him with whiskey.
Yeah, they found him in the water, right? He was just swimming around. He'd been swimming for 40 minutes or something.
Yeah, and his hair wasn't even wet. And he managed to, like, cut, there was one life raft that was, like, kind of capsized and he managed to sort of attach himself to that.
Yeah.
And then he got pulled into another life raft. But yeah, he was so drunk, he said later, I didn't even know it was cold. So I feel like he's kind of the legend of the Titanic in many ways.
That's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So he's pretty cool, I think. And he's really quite casual about the whole thing too. Wow. Doesn't he? Oh, yeah.
He was involved in an event that killed a lot of people, to be quite casual about it.
Yeah, he's in Titanic, the movie, as well. You can see him when Rose and Jack are holding on. He's also there.
Oh, true.
Yeah, great, he's like in a baker's outfit. Yeah.
On the rails. On the rails. They climb. Okay,
yeah,
that makes
sense. Yeah, he's there.
Can't get one past Jim Cameron.
Yeah.
Calla, who was your favourite character from the event?
Normally I say Thomas Andrews is the most interesting passenger to me, who was...
Architect.
The architect of the ship, who tried to save a bunch of people through a lot of rafts over there. And I just find his story so interesting and compelling. Also, there's this beautiful detail, which is like such a specific Easter egg for people who have read into the Titanic, which is in the film. You probably know this.
Is it the little moment he has by himself? Yeah.
With the painting?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I think about that all the time.
Yeah, so this is like...
All right, one of you's got to tell me what's going on here.
Oh, you go, Carlo.
I'm glad you're on the same page as me, as they say. But yeah, there's one of these, I think it was a stewardess. There's like conflicting reports of where he was last seen. So some people saw him like making the deck chair rafts. One stewardess said that they saw him standing at the mantelpiece in the, I think it's the gentleman's smoking room, but where he is in the film, looking at this painting. And that painting was of, I think it's called Belfast Lock, which is the body of water in Belfast, which is where he grew up. And so this last moment is apparently him just staring at this body of water that you'll never see again. And then he adjusted the clock to the correct time. And I think the correct time in Belfast, but I may have just made that up to romanticize it. But yeah, so this is just this lovely little moment of a guy who he knew there was no hope. He didn't try and get off, and he just stood there looking back on this painting of you know, his home, which I think is quite a touching story.
Yeah, it's this incredible little moment, like amongst the chaos, he just took a little bit of time to himself to just sort of sit and look at the painting for a few moments, and then I guess charged back into the chaos again.
Mm.
But yeah, it is this incredible moment that I think about all the time.
But Carla, you said that wasn't even your number one.
Yes, who's
this
your number
like
one?
This was like an ancillary character.
He's normally my number one. Because we talked about him a lot in the podcast, the other person is Masabumi Hosono, who was the only Japanese passenger, and he survived the disaster. And this kind of speaks more broadly about, like, there were a lot of men who did survive, and the film really portrays it as, like, Bruce Ismay being, like, the only non-crew male who survived. But there were a lot that did. And when Hosono got back to Japan, he just became this national figure of disgrace, and they just absolutely pilloried him when he got back to Japan, and he kind of lived the rest of his life just constantly having this event that he survived being thrown back in his face. It was just such a source of national shame, and he was too proud while he was alive to reveal this correspondence that he'd kept with one of the other survivors. And I think it was his children or his grandson, whose grandson is also like considered to be one of the most influential Japanese pop musicians. It's all on Spotify. It's amazing. You got to check out his stuff. Hitomi Hosono. Anyway, one of either his grandson or his children, they revealed all of these letters that had been sent to Hosono from other survivors. And apparently he was like so brave and stoic during this event, and he helped so many people get into lifeboats. And it was just this moment where the lifeboat was pretty much full, and they're like, come in, you get into this lifeboat. And he was actually like a bit of a hero, but he was so proud. He was like, I'll never show these letters to anybody. And so they were eventually revealed, and his name was cleared in Japan. But yeah, it's just a really interesting story to me.
That's interesting, because Bruce Ismay kind of had a similar thing, right, where he was absolutely vilified by the American press. He was the highest ranking member of White Star that survived. You know, he's vilified, obviously, in Titanic the movie. And his wife forbade him to talk about it at home. And he never talked about the Titanic, to the extent that one of his grandchildren asked him, oh, you worked on the sea. Were you ever in any shipwrecks? And then he said, I was in one. And that was about it. But he poured his heart out to this fellow passenger, Marion Thayer, I believe her name was. But he wrote these letters talking about his shame and how he felt. And he just poured his absolute soul out to this woman. She was kind of like, wow, that's a bit intense. After a year, she started writing to his wife.
Oh, only. My God.
But she almost did like the equivalent of like a CCing in.
Oh no.
His wife, just to be like, hey, you know, this is not the vibe for me.
You need to talk to your husband, lady.
Yeah.
He's got some stuff to get off his chest.
I think he tried to kind of like put the vibe out there a little bit, because I think he said something like, oh, you know, if only, you know, when I first met you, I thought maybe this could be an interesting relationship. He said something like that.
And well, then he doesn't sound like he was a totally great dude then.
Yeah.
He may have been vilified in the press for the wrong reasons, but, you know.
No, he sucked. Like, I think that's why people didn't like him.
Was he quite an easy guy to kind of set up as being the villain of
100%. He was super, he was really weird. Like, he was super intense and boring. Like, he's the kind of person that would, like, corner you in a conversation and tell you all about, like, things. And he also ate exactly the same thing for dinner every single night, pretty much for the rest of his life. And it was just like cold turkey.
What was this, after the event?
After the event. So even
this is like PTSD or something.
Like, even if his wife.
It's not being boring, Abby. No. That is dealing with intense trauma.
I know.
Badly.
Even if his wife had a dinner party and was serving something else, he would say, no, 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 cold turkey for me.
Oh my God. It's not even a hot turkey. It's not even a hot bird.
Yeah. I just find him so fascinating as a person.
Slightly sympathetic, but also not. Well, sorry, Carla. What were you
going
to say?
Yeah, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, I agree with you, Abby. Like, I'm so interested in Bruce Ismay. And I, after listening to the last episode back, I started wondering if, like, maybe he is the bassist for those cinema villains of, like, the guy with the moustache and the top hat. And, I haven't looked into it, but I am really intrigued by how, you know, readily lampooned he is, in that he just has this villainous look. But then I started to wonder, is the reason that we associate that kind of long twirled moustache and top hat with villainy because of Bruce Ismay?
Wow.
Yeah.
Because his image presumably would have been splashed across newspapers throughout the US and then sort of reflected in the media at the time.
He was in cartoons, like they cartooned him, like, because famously he, like, when the Titanic was sinking and he was in life raft, he turned away from the boat as it was sinking, and there's this quite famous cartoon of him like turning away from the boat. So
oh,
he was
God.
I think you could make a very compelling argument for that, Carlo. But yeah, I find him really interesting. And he had a stroke later in life, and he had a diabetes and he lost his leg. But he rigged up this kind of invention so no one would have to take him to the toilet. He could do it himself.
Wow, good on him. I can understand that. Can I ask you two a dumb question?
Yeah.
Which we never visited in the podcast. And maybe I'll throw this to you first, Carlo. I kind of forgot to ask you because we got so swept up in the details. But this is something that I heard about Titanic on the internet ages ago. Was Tutankhamun on board?
No, definitely not.
Where did that come from?
It was a conspiracy that the Titanic sank because of a mummy's curse, and that they had the corpse of a mummy on there. Tutankhamun wasn't discovered until, what year is it now? 1922, because it's 100 years ago he was discovered.
Oh, right.
On the 24th of November or 25th of November 1922. So it wasn't Tutankhamun, and it wasn't any other mummy. There's no evidence that there was ever a mummy on the Titanic at all. But it is quite a compelling conspiracy. It's a good story.
I'm glad we cleared it up, because I assume there's at least a couple listeners who have been listening through half a dozen episodes waiting for the Tutankhamun curse to be addressed.
Where's Tutankhamun? They're going to mention him soon.
Well, Abby, We've asked everyone. I feel like I may know the answer to this question, but in your opinion, did Titanic sink?
Yes, I think it did sink. I don't think it was the Olympic. I think it was the Titanic. But like I said, do I believe some rich guy had an absolute disregard for human life? Completely.
Those two things can coexist.
Yeah.
Does a doubt exist that didn't exist before, Abby?
Oh, certainly. Like, I definitely heard you out completely. And I'm not completely against conspiracy theory. So I kind of believe in ghosts too. So it's like, who am I to talk?
Those are two quite different things.
It's all coming out.
Well, Abby, thank you so much for joining us on this episode and for your kind words about the podcast. I was so excited to get you on this at some point. I'm so glad that you and Carlo have had a chance to discuss these important matters with each other. And thanks for being a part of this project.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel full up with sunshine and I'm on the road to my heart. It looked like you were going to salute me for a second there, Carlo.
I will salute you, Dr. Howe.
I feel like a salute would be appropriate. So I will salute you as well. I will salute you as a sort of, even though I don't believe your theory entirely, as a fellow traveller on this path, I respect the heck out of you.
Dr. Howes, it's great to meet another ship out here in the middle of the sea.
Thanks so much for listening, and stay subscribed to get our live show episode in November. Speaking of which, if you're in Auckland, we'd love to see you at the Did Titanic Sink live show, happening on November 18 at Soap Dance Hall in the CBD. For live show tickets and details, go to didtitanicsink.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.